before we commence episode 4, I'd just like to do a massive shout out to Maya Walker. Many of you have probably seen my new Jacobs podcast logo, but it wouldn't have been possible without Maya's fantastic and really hard work. Maya's a Brisbane-based artist, graphic designer and communication specialist. Her work is available at maya-walker.com. Maya, I'm really proud to say, is a former colleague and a really good friend. Thank you, Maya. We really appreciate the fantastic logo you've been able to do for us at the Jacobs podcast. Welcome, dear listeners, to episode 4 of the Jacobs podcast. In this episode, I switch it up and interview Michael Coates, author of Manus Days, The Untold Story of Manus Island. It really is an insider's account of Australia's offshore processing regime in Papua New Guinea. As someone who worked on Manus and saw the day-to-day reality versus what was reported in the media and some books, I think his book brings an otherwise important perspective to what has been a really pertinent issue in Australia over the past few years. We talk about how one finds themselves on Manus, transferee life, the realities of the resettlement program, and the reception he's received back here in Australia, and the myths that he's had to dispel. The book is available by Connacourt Publishing. Enjoy. Okay, Michael Coates, welcome to the Jacobs podcast.
Okay, thanks for seeing us here, mate.
Excellent. So first, listeners, we are doing this from a pub in Brisbane, so apologies, listeners, for the clinking of glasses and cutlery, and our glasses in particular, so just bear with us on that one. So, Michael, just firstly on the reception for the book itself, I think I saw you on Sky News a few weeks ago. You've done Ray Hadley or Alan Jones, I'm not sure, but you've had a couple of book launches as well. What's the reception been like for the book since you launched it?
Yeah, man, it's all been pretty positive. It's been, it's just been good to see people interested. You never really know when you do something like this whether anyone's going to care or think what you're doing is any good. So it's been pretty cool to just meet different people, and it's also shown how small the world is, because you're always meeting people there that know someone that was in the book or something like that, and just meeting different people that way has been pretty interesting as well.
Fair enough. I guess meeting people like myself as well. So just full disclosure, I was also on Manus Island at the MRPC, the Manus Regional Processing Centre. So Michael and I are sort of somewhat former colleagues, except, I had very different...
Ships in the night.
That's
really,
right, yeah. Yeah.
We probably ran into each other at breakfast when I was coming off a night shift maybe, and we'd just be going to different parts of the day. And,
yeah, correct. That's right. And I also had a very different role. So working outside, I have my office in the processing centre, but then a lot of my work as a community liaison was outside the wire, as I call it, with local government and community groups. So... I'm not surprised about the reception it's received, and a positive one at that, and clearing the air on a lot of things on Manus. So I'm really glad you've written this. So I just tell us a bit, Michael, about the journey to Manus. You're an ex-soldier. I remember you had a short stint holidaying in South Africa. You looked at the Middle East. You did some work back in the security world here in Brisbane, and I'm using inverted commas here with other hand, because a lot of it seems like it was pretty simple, or base compliance work that frustrated you a lot before you got the call up to go to Manus. Just talk us through the journey to Manus, Michael.
Yeah, it was sort of a story, like they say, it's not what you know, it's who you know in a lot of ways. I'd been on holidays and that for a long time, and came back and realised I needed to sort of grow up and jump back into the real world and get a job. And luckily enough, it was an opportunity that had come up that a few of my friends had gotten involved in, and they were able to point me in the right direction of who to talk to. And in a lot of ways, it was a case of being right place at right time. And when I got the call, and basically, it was literally a matter of within 24 hours of getting an email, I was on the ground there. So it all happened pretty quickly, but luckily for me, I was in the right place at the right time to take advantage of it.
Yep, absolutely. And I know it was really exciting when I got the call. It wasn't in that sort of state of flux about the... Because you guys were almost deploying overnight or on the same day, is that right?
Yeah, literally. I got... they asked me whether I could go, sometime in the afternoon. I didn't really take them seriously. I thought it was a bit of a joke and said no, but then they rang me that evening and said, look, we really do need you to go. And I think it was about 5 a.m. the next morning I was at the airport waiting for a plane. So, that's how quickly it did unfold.
Fair enough. Yeah. Absolutely, and the one of the first things I encountered when getting to the processing center is the two generators out the front and just the constant noise that they make and the heat they generate as well. But then also the other thing is just how it's broken into compounds, and can you just maybe talk a bit about that, Michael, about the compounds at Bannister?
Yeah, well, as you probably noticed yourself, it was all pretty ad hoc, as in every compound had been built in a different time frame, really, as the place had expanded. It had, you know, a new compound would spring up next door, which would bear no real resemblance to the one next to it. You know, the original compounds being, you know, the old naval housing that was on, it's on a Navy base, obviously, that was there. And then, but the other interesting thing that people maybe don't realise is that every time a new compound would spring up, it would be the staff housing that would be taken over to form the new compound. So a lot of the compounds were former staff housing. So when people used to say that, you know, oh, they're living in squalor, it's like, well, that's what the staff were living in last month. So, yeah, take that into it. And I'm not sure when you arrived, whether it was before they did all the, we used to call them the renovations, but yeah.
2015.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So you
probably before.
So yeah, it was probably looking even more impressive by the time you got there.
Yeah.
But yeah, like we literally, there wasn't even a fence really. Like, so it was which is another thing that people always say about razor wire and everything. It's just like you saw for yourself. There was no razor wire. It was just all cyclone fencing really, and the doors weren't, gates weren't even locked. So
Sure.
And it definitely wasn't the old dilapidated weatherboards that were on the old part of the Navy bases I always showed photos of.
Yeah.
Or tents. Yeah.
Fair enough. Absolutely, that's what I always thought when I used to come back on break after seeing it firsthand, is you'd see footage of Manus and you'd think, gosh, like, where is that? Well, that hasn't existed, that, you know, that structure hasn't existed for years and years, but it would kept getting recycled and put out there.
You'd notice the background of the photo, so you could see where that used to be, but it clearly hasn't been there for a long time. But
that's
just people using Google Images, I guess.
That's right. And so just in terms of inside the centre, and I just want to touch on the reality of day-to-day life, and just how the, you know, the welfare of the transferee. You get some very wild reception back here about, and perceptions too, about how transferees are treated. And I know you make the point that in the book, I'll just quote here, it had been a long-running joke at the MRPC that if a transferee punched an SSA in the face, that the concern would be for the transferee's hand. Just firstly, what's an SSA, and then can you just expand a bit on that quote?
Yeah, SSA is a Safety and Security Advisor, which was our formal title there, because our main job there was to be mentoring and training the local staff to eventually take over running of operations there. So that was our formal title. But it just went to show that, you know, a lot of the violent incidents that people talk about occurring there weren't initiated by the Australian staff there. But like we said, there's various instances of Australian staff and local PNG staff there being very badly injured in incidents there. But there was never any real. The concern would be, you know, how does the transferee that's injured him now feel? When they could turn around and claim that seeing the person they injured traumatised them and people losing their jobs over stuff like that, it was definitely a pretty one-sided affair as far as that was shown.
Yeah, sure. And just as also around mental, not just physical health, but thoughts of self-harm, inverted commas, and then also high-risk classification. So I know you're right, expressing thoughts of self-harm, all were placed on high risk. The threat of self-harm resulted in a higher at-risk level than actual acts of self-harm. This led to the whole thing being open to serious abuse by the very people it was supposed to be looking out for. Very sort of warped incentives there.
Yeah, people go, and the first, I'll say straight up, as everyone probably knows, I'm not a mental health expert, I'm not a psychologist, and that's the first criticism I always get. It's like, well, you're not an expert. Of course not, but I know what I can see, and I have no doubt there's a lot of people there that would be probably experiencing some sort of mental health problems as a result of their life before, or as a result of things they may have experienced there, not, you know, at the hands of the Australian government, but at the hands of their fellow transferees. And yeah, it's without a doubt, because I saw it with my own eyes for years on end, that playing the mental health system that was in place there was definitely a tactic that some of the more manipulative transferees could use in order to drum up media attention back in Australia. So whenever you see articles about that, you always got to take that with a grain of salt, because it was a lot more calculated in my experience than a lot of people might have you believe. Not to take away from, you know, some genuine cases that were obviously occurring there.
Yeah.
And in my time there, I could see certain individuals, I remember, and seeing their own personal decline during their time there. Funnily enough, though, those individuals weren't the ones you were always seeing in incidents.
Yeah.
People that were, yeah, staging certain incidents in order to squander resources or something.
Sure.
Yeah, in that regard.
Yeah.
And look, you talk about that reception back home, or just trying to manipulate that, the optics of it to gain favour back home, and the domestic reception back home in Australia. And you talk about an instance in West End where you're out having a couple of drinks, I think, with some friends, and then it came up that you worked at the on Manus. And, you know, I've been in that situation before. I did run for local government on the centre-right side of politics in West End, where there's probably not a huge amount of enthusiasm for offshore processing in a place like West End or the inner city. But I remember the person saying, "Oh my God, you're not cruel to them, are you? Just tell us about that."
It wasn't really that big a deal. It was just having some drinks with some school friends I hadn't seen for years. It was at a bar in West End. The End. That's where it was.
Yeah,
they nearly poisoned me that night with some weird pickle shot thing. But and just some of their friends, found out I worked there, and they were just absolutely horrified for that split second, saying, "Oh God, you're not like cruel to them or whatever." And I was just like, "Well, no, why would I be?" Like, and then they're like, "Oh, okay, cool," and just didn't come up again. So I don't think the average person is going to really care, really. Because, like, you know, they always talk about, oh, you know, put a human face on the story. And, well, in a way, I was the human face of it to them. Because I was the only person who'd been there that they'd ever met. And I guess I didn't come across as a monster to them, so they were quite fine to carry on with the rest of the evening.
Yeah. And that perception thing is a really interesting part of things. You know, I've got good friends who are very, you know, like, intelligent people who should know better, have given the same reaction as well about thinking that what Manus is or was is something like Guantanamo, Camp X-Ray, or something, you know, comparing it to something of times past.
Yeah.
But
most people would say that would have been to either of those places, so I don't know how they'd make a very informed comparison.
That's right, and you made that point at the start of the book as well.
Yeah. Comparing somewhere they haven't been to another place they haven't been is not the most enlightened way to go about things, is it? But
Now, Michael, just turning to the local impacts on Manus, you know, there's a lot of positive and negative ones, I guess, and, you know, my job as a community liaison was to look at, I guess, more of the positive stuff. Just tell us a bit about what you saw, and you do talk about this in the book, about the local impacts, both positive and negative, in the book.
Well, like you said, I reckon you could probably even give a more interesting account of this, because you would have seen a lot more of that. But what I could see, and it changed over time, was first of all, the employment thing you mentioned, it did create a large amount of employment opportunities for the local guys there, and girls obviously, but I think that it was a double-edged sword in a way, because you're taking that community that didn't have any real large-scale industry like that, so people were abandoning, I guess, their traditional occupations, whether they were fishermen or, you know, farmers and stuff, to come work at the centre. And they, I guess you probably noticed, I definitely didn't notice, they didn't really have a concept of working to a roster like we did, so it caused a lot of sort of a lot of dramas locally early on. But the biggest thing I noticed was that the amount of money getting pumped into the local economy that was basically coming out of nowhere was creating a massive opportunity for the whole island, or the whole province rather. But at the end of the day, I think the only people that are going to really see any big benefit of that are a few of the landowners at the top, because I'm sure you noticed as well, a lot of that money wasn't going to where it was meant to go. I still remember that road into Loringau, that millions of dollars pumped into that, and I don't think a road ever really appeared there. It all went somewhere, but I do wonder what would happen when the whole thing ended there, and it was suddenly that opportunities were all gone.
Sure.
But it did, I think, the positive, on the positive side, it gave a lot of the local guys exposure to operations and stuff that they never would have got beforehand, and I hope a lot of them can really make something of it in the future, whether they move into other roles over in PNG, that they can use that training experience they got there.
Yeah,
that's what I hope for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and look, I did pull out ahead of the interview some of the positive impacts, and there was a proper sort of study done by the company, and you did talk about it, the economic impact. So I've got this here, 29 PNG companies, including 5 Manus companies, providing goods and services to the RPC worth around 1.5 million kina per week. And again, that's money that wouldn't have otherwise been there. And you know, you just look at local employment, like you touched on at the top, it's just, the stat I had was just under 900 of the 1,100 PNG citizens employed at the RPC were from Manus. So, you know, again, those are jobs that otherwise wouldn't be there. And I think the skill opportunities were something that, again, like you finished up with, like training in first aid, advanced security, incident response, leadership and management sort of type roles. Those are all opportunities that wouldn't have been there. And they're definitely some of the positive aspects of things. And I do, I pulled out a quote here again from one of the points you made about just, it did create this sort of situation where the RPC was the focus of the everything there, as it, you know, would be given that its impact and the concentration of resources. But you know, the kids pretty much abandoned for days whilst their parents dropped everything to work at the centre. You know, you did make that point. I think it was a really interesting one.
That's you would notice on the few occasions that we'd get to go out and move through local communities, you would notice it was almost a bit of a Lord and the Flies sort of situation with kids wandering around, and you'd hear about it because some parents not used to having to actually go somewhere other than home to work or to work to set hours. So I think I do think they probably adapted to it fairly quickly, but definitely in the early days it was fairly disruptive. But they definitely, as time went by, you could see things that the community adapted to it a lot more and became a lot more invested in making it work, that's for sure.
Excellent. And just sort of moving towards the end of the interview, but it obviously, what was holding things back is the processing. You know, that was the whole focus or goal of actually having the regional processing center there. So a lot of it relied on the capacity of the PNG government. And there's PNG ICSA, which is the immigration authority in PNG, who are tasked with processing the transferees. You do have some pretty candid insights there on the capacity of the PNG government, having worked in PNG and sort of half being from there. You know, I have seen up close some of the capacity issues, but just talk us through that as well, about what you saw in terms of some of the local authorities, and I guess why we had those bottlenecks with processing up there.
Well, I also think a lot of that, a lot of those problems with processing can be put down to the transferees themselves, because the processing was, in my non-expert opinion, just by watching it day to day, was actually running very pretty smoothly. I thought the problem was a lot of transferees then refusing their positive determination they received from the PNG government, refusing to accept their refugee status, and then remaining at the centre, under giving people the impression they were being imprisoned there when they were being asked to move out into their new communities. And another thing that people have to realise that I don't think was made very clear, or was probably obscured by those same transferees, as they weren't expected to stay on Manus Island. They were free to move onto the mainland, into the the more professional opportunities available in places like Moresby. Once they'd completed their, the process of integration. So, the fact that a lot of those people refused to accept that process was what I think caused a lot of the problems that were going on there. And as for the capacity of PNG XR, I think a big problem was, which was what I noticed, I think a lot of people maybe were employed there because of their own family connections and not their professional expertise in that regard. So that definitely didn't help with the day-to-day running of operations. But I think a big part of that has got to be placed on the transferees themselves. And I think it's also got to be said that a lot of them did accept it and did move on to the mainland and start the next phase of their lives. So a lot of responsibility has got to be taken there for the people that just didn't want to play the process because it wasn't what they signed up for when they paid the people smugglers, which is their choice to make. But at the end of the day, it can't be blamed on just not opportunities not being presented for them.
Absolutely. And look, just sort of wrapping up with, what are your thoughts on the RPC in the future, the processing centre? There's a lot of hardware put in, a lot of infrastructure, and especially when I finished up there, a lot of the medical centre, a lot of the infrastructure had been completed, but only to sort of dry up again and not get used. Do you think it'll be stood up again in the future? What are your thoughts there?
Who knows? It's all speculation, I guess. If you look at the history of what's happened there the last 20, 30 years, you could be looking at all it would take is a change of government and a change of policies, and in 10 years time you might see the place getting opened again and the whole cycle starting again. And I don't think it had happened, but I wouldn't be surprised either. And as for the facilities there, the fact that a lot of them, especially those medical facilities and the accommodation that was built there, being on the naval base, might be put to use more to the local PNG forces there. But how much of it benefits the locals, I don't know, because obviously you could have all the facilities in the world, but when the funding's no longer there, they'll just, I don't know, maybe we go back there in 10 years' time and that'll be like the old facilities we found there when we first rocked up, just overgrown by jungle and legacy of days gone by.
Sure, well, I remember seeing what was supposedly MacArthur's house there, it was still standing. On the hill.
I saw that. But I used to hear about it, but I thought that was a bit of an urban legend. I didn't actually ever find that.
Yeah, it's funny. Everywhere you sort of visit in the southeast of Asia or the Pacific is MacArthur's house. Thanks very much, Michael. Really appreciate it. And I think, as well, we just touched on before the interview off air, just talking a bit about how a lot of ex-ADF guys like yourself are joining the public discussion. We've had Kevin Bailey, who ran for the Australian Conservatives in the Batman by-election, Andrew Hastie, the ex-SAS officer, who's now the federal member for Canning, WA, Jim Molan, retired brigadier, who's now a senator in New South Wales. And a lot of those people have spent a lot of time just not just practically involved in current affairs and the public discussion, but just in written work, especially Jim Molan. That's a good trend, a positive one, you think?
Oh, it seems positive so far. Like everyone, people like Jim Molan and Andrew Hastie, I think, are pretty stand-up guys, so I'm happy to see them getting out there, and they are able to lend a bit of extra credibility when they took, obviously, when they're speaking about things in their field, because lots of people in politics bring different things to the table, but definitely gives them just that extra bit of credibility, and it's good to sort of know where a person's coming from when they talk about certain issues, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that perspective and that credibility is just displayed in this book, Manus Days, The Untold Story of Manus Island by Michael Coates, published by Connor Court, so I encourage listeners to go out and buy a copy. Thanks again, Michael Coates, for joining us on the Jacobs Podcast.
Thanks, mate. Good to see you.
Excellent. Well, thank you, listeners. That wraps up episode 4 of the Jacobs Podcast on my interview with Michael Coates, author of Manus Days. I really do encourage you to get out and procure a copy, available by Connor Court Publishing. A reminder to please get in touch at seanjacobs.com.au for any feedback or topics for future discussion. Thank you and happy listening.